Evaluating the legacy of Kenneth Kaunda, one-time dictator of Zambia. Frontline Fellowship has been working in the front lines for 39 years, and Zambia has been an important part of our mission field. The first president of Zambia, Kenneth Kaunda, has died. Report came in last week, Friday. And Kenneth Kaunda was the head of this Central African country, Zambia, which, as you can see, is very strategically situated. It's a landlocked country, but surrounded by countries in turmoil, many of which it helped to create the turmoil. Kenneth David Kaunda, the first president of Zambia, died on the 17th of June, 2021, at age 97. As he was Zambia's first president in office from 24th of October, 1964, to 2nd of November, 1991, many are seeking to evaluate his legacy, and he's been praised as the father of democracy, republicanism, Africa's founding father, many things, one of the great leaders of freedom and democracy and so on. To know something about the family of Kenneth Kaunda is intriguing, because Kenneth Kaunda, or KK as he was popularly known, was born in Chinsali in northern Rhodesia, what today is Zambia, 28th April 1924. His wife Betsy, who he married in 1946, died in 2012. Now, they had eight children. Before entering politics, KK was a teacher. Now, he was the youngest of eight children himself. His father was Reverend David Kaunda, a well-loved, highly respected Church of Scotland missionary and teacher who was born in Nyasaland, what today is Malawi, and who was trained in Livingstonia. And so Kenneth Kaunda's father was a God-fearing man, as was his mother, and he was raised in a fine Christian family, received an excellent education. However, in university, he turned to humanism, and he's the author of the book, A Humanist in Africa. KK wrote in his book, A Humanist in Africa, that he could never agree with the Calvinist convictions of his parents, who believed in the depravity of man. KK asserted he believed in the goodness of man. And so you can see when he became president, he produced the Humanism in Africa guide to its implementation. That was the founding policy of Zambia. By the way, here you can see KK in Washington, D.C., entering the temple of Abraham Lincoln, who's the patron saint of socialists and communists worldwide. And it's intriguing how many Christians don't seem to realize this is where Fidel Castro, every Marxist goes. They all revere Abraham Lincoln for what he stood for. And so did Karl Marx. Karl Marx and Abraham Lincoln were correspondents, and Karl Marx was a great defender of the atrocities of Abraham Lincoln in his war against the South. And that's why in this, in many communist countries, they've got the Abraham Lincoln High School, Abraham Lincoln Boulevards, like in Cuba. And Kenneth Kaunda wanted to pose right here with his idol in many ways. And this is an idol. Abraham Lincoln is an idol. You can see inside the wording above that throne, that imperial Roman throne, in this temple, as in the hearts of a people for whom he saved the Union. The memory of Abraham Lincoln will live forever. I mean, it's all religious terminology. Temple, enshrined, hearts, saved forever. And yet, for some reason, many people are blind to own idolatry. It's interesting how many Christians will say, you know, how terrible the people in Israel could turn to idols. You know, we'd never do that. Of course, we've got TV programs called idols. We've got sports idols. We've got soccer idols. We've got political idols. There's rock idols. There's all sorts of idols in the modern world. But we don't recognize them for the idols that God condemned in the Old Covenant and for which he abandoned his people and abandoned Jerusalem to the Babylonians. When KK became president of Zambia, here being sworn in on the steps of the Supreme Court in Lusaka, he worked to promote socialist humanism as the ruling ideology of the country. And so Kenneth Kaunda used terms like Zambian humanism and African socialism. You can tell where he is coming from. He believed in the goodness of man, remember. And so at that stage, he was part of the Federation, the Central African Federation, includes Northern Rhodesia, today Zambia, Southern Rhodesia, today Zimbabwe, Nyasaland, today Malawi. And the Central African Federation was phenomenally successful. It was a powerhouse. It was the most powerful federation country, group of countries in the whole of Central Africa, and they were showing the way forward. But he wanted to kill the federation and for Zambia to go it alone, and that broke up the Central African Federation. And then he wanted a one-party state as well. After protests of corruption and vote rigging in the first elections, 1968 elections, Kahunda banned all political parties except UNIP, that's his own party, the United National Independence Party. When there was a breakaway from UNIP by one of his members, very respected member, Simon Kapwepe, in 1972 to form the United Progressive Party, Kahunda moved to suppress it, and he changed the constitution to reduce Zambia to a one-party state. And it was effectively a dictatorship. KK had this throne, sorry for the poor quality of the picture, but I took it through glass in the museum. These elephant tusks around with the eagle, and that's where he sat in his throne in front of Parliament. Instead of having the Speaker of the House being in the center and the Prime Minister being the side, he was enthroned like an emperor in the center, and that was that spoke volumes, just the architecture of how Parliament was set up. Thereafter, Kenneth Kaunda was the sole candidate in future elections. All opposition was eliminated, and a personality cult was built around Kenneth Kaunda. Zambia, Kenneth Kaunda, same thing. Reminds you of Louis XIV, the Sun King, who said, I am France and France is me. You know? And the idea that my word is law, the king's word is law. King is the law, he's above the law. All internal dissension was suppressed, particularly in Western Zambia and Lawsiland, which used to be known as Barutsiland, which was actually a very large part of Zambia originally. Barutsiland was its own country and it still has its own king. The Lozi was suppressed, viciously suppressed in Western Zambia. Now, the Lozi live up in the source of the Zambezi River, and they are very much a river people. And so Barutsiland, Western Zambia, they had requested Britain to make it a protectorate, and they had made treaties with Cecil John Rhodes's British South Africa Company people in 1890 already. With the Portuguese on one side, they were concerned for protection. Remember, the Portuguese were the last European country to still be involved in slavery, whereas Britain was famous for its opposition to slavery. And so many kings, like in Swaziland, Lesotho, asked for Britain to make them a protectorate. And the Lozi were amongst those who did, the Barotse at that stage. So the Barotse king asked for Britain to make it a protectorate, and they had their own currency for quite a while as well. I mean, this is from the Barotse Central Bank, Barotse Shilling. And Barutsiland at one stage was a much larger area than it is recognized to be now. The stipulation of the agreement with the British that if the British ever left Northern Rhodesia, that they would grant Lawsiland its independence so that they could go their separate ways again. They could trust the British to rule them in a central state. British did indirect rule, let the Lawsi king and chiefs rule them, really. But they did not want to be under a central government of an independent Zambia. The King of the Lozi was presented a black and gold British Admiral's uniform by King Edward VII in recognition of a treaty that had been signed between the Lozis and Queen Victoria. And in fact, to this day, he wears that as his uniform. So the Queen Mother visiting Zambia, she would pay a special visit to the Barotse King, and there he is wearing his British Admiral's uniform. And plainly, there was always a good relationship between the royal family of Lawsiland and the royal family of Great Britain. This is the royal barge, canoe, yacht, not sure what the correct word is, and the symbol of the great elephants on top. That's the king would be enthroned under there, and this is all part of their river ceremonies. Very colorful people, river people. You can understand why in the Northern Rhodesian flag, they've got the waves below symbolizing the rivers. And so, and the fish eagle, of course. So this is what the Central African Republic Federation was. Southern Rhodesia, Northern Rhodesia, Nyasaland. And that's why they all speak English, even though they're flanked by Portuguese-speaking Angola, Portuguese-speaking Mozambique, and French-speaking Congo. But this was, at one stage, one federation. And in the federation, Northern Rhodesia was the rich cousin. I mean, they were mineral rich, copper belt, the whole lot. And they had a huge amount of currency, and they were the rich cousins. They were the industrialized north. The poor cousins to the south of Zambezi, southern Rhodesians, they just had mainly an agricultural economy and were poor in comparison to the Zambians. That's the way it was at independence. Unfortunately, however, the Lozi people were denied their independence, and all attempts at self-determination by its people were suppressed by Kenneth Kaunda. KK suppressed the Lozi and placed Western Zambia under martial law, which it was for the whole 27 years that he was president. Western Zambia was denied self-determination, self-expression, and the normal freedoms that might have been tolerated in other parts of the country were not tolerated in Western Zambia. And the Barotse land got more and more encroached until this is now recognized as Barotse land or Lozi land in Western Zambia. A lot of the other territories just got shaved off. Again, you can see the Barotse king arriving in his British admiral's uniform in his special. You can see the black and white line boat, which you saw in this Northern Rhodesian flag, the same color scheme. Well, Zambia was in the very front line of the Cold War and a key player in perpetrating the Cold War in southern Africa, because Zambia is surrounded by countries that at that stage in 1964 were controlled by what they considered the enemy. And so there was Portuguese West Africa, Angola, there's Portuguese East Africa, Mozambique, there's southern Rhodesia, there was Southwest Africa, and of course South Africa. And Zambia fomented revolution in all these neighboring countries. During the Cold War, Kenneth Kaunda maintained an open, close relationship with Marxist dictators such as Joseph Broz Tito of Yugoslavia and Nicolae Ceausescu, depicted here, of Romania, known as Dracula by his own people. Fidel Castro of Cuba and Brezhnev of the Soviet Union, and with the Red Chinese dictator Mao Zedong. Here is Kenneth Kaunda doing a Colgate toothpaste advert smile with Mao Zedong. And, of course, Leonid Brezhnev of the Soviet Union. Many of the streets in Lusaka were named after famous Marxist dictators, revolutionaries, and terrorists like Ben Bella Kun, not just Fidel Castro, but Che Guevara. Many, many terrorist names you'll just see driving down the streets of Lusaka. A man is known by the company he keeps and by his friends. And, of course, when he went to America, he was well-received by Martin Luther King Jr., who I think is maybe looking a little put out by this person who's maybe taking some of the limelight. But the fact is, Kenneth Kaunda was an autocratic dictator of a one-party state. He was autocratic. He personally appointed the Central Committee of the United National Independence Party. The Central Committee in turn nominated the sole candidate, the only candidate for the party presidency. And since all the members of the Central Committee had been appointed by Kaunda and were answerable to him, he was always the sole candidate and all dissension was suppressed. This you can see in the museums today in Zambia. UNIP and the National Party, United National Independence Party membership card with a picture of KK, total hero worship, personality cult of the whole thing. He was the candidate. And so the whole slogan was one nation, one people, one party, one leader, one vote, one choice, that sort of thing. And he made Zambia a launching pad for revolutionary insurgents. And so you can see Kenneth Kaunda, Samora Machel of Mozambique, and Julius Nyerere of Tanzania, and they're wearing East German military fatigues, showing them, not that I think they've ever done actual warfare in the bush, but there's a lot of people like to wear camouflage even if they don't even do anything that needs it. KK was also famous for hosting active support of revolutionary guerrilla movements such as Robert Mugabe's. Now here you can see KK had a habit of wearing safari suits. And so you can see a lot of people decide to copy his safari suit style. In fact, you can even Google Kenneth Kaunda safari suits and there's a whole line of them, just like you get Madiba shirts over here. He aimed at the overthrowing of the neighbors of Zambia, including the FNLA, the MPLA, and UNITA were all targeting Portuguese West Africa and Angola, so they were welcomed into Zambia to use Western Zambia as a staging post for launching guerrilla insurgency attacks on Angola. And they were helped by the Cubans. Cuban military came in great numbers to train the MPLA, and later the Cubans came by the tens of thousands into Angola to help suppress all dissent. On the eastern frontier, they were helping Frelimo, targeting the Portuguese East Africa of Mozambique. And here's the Mozambique magazine, Tempo, of Frelimo. ZANU and ZAPU targeting Rhodesia. Now, ZANU were trained and armed by the Red Chinese, and ZAPU were trained and armed by the Soviets, and both of them were welcomed into Zambia, and they were able to use Zambia as their staging post for training. In fact, it's interesting, we planted a Bible college up in Petiuka, which back in Kahunda's days had been a terrorist training camp for terrorists of ZAPU attacking Rhodesia. And so we've got Covenant College up there in Petiuka, what used to be a staging post for attacks on Rhodesia. You can see them here using the Chinese SKS rifles with the folding pig sticker bayonets. And here with the AK-47s, and that's a 12,7 anti-aircraft gun, all in training in Zambia. Rhodesia was being targeted from the north by the Russian-supported ZAPU, in particular, coming down from them. The ZANU, the Red Chinese-supported, moved quickly into Mozambique when that opened up in 1975, and they started to attack Rhodesia from the east, and ZAPU also moved through Botswana to attack Rhodesia. So Rhodesia was effectively surrounded. On 85% of its border was hot. There was only one bridge, one railway line, Bight Bridge, across the Limpopo, providing any kind of lifeline to the outside world. So Rhodesia really was under siege, and many of the terrorists came from Zambia and later from Mozambique. SWAPO also had their headquarters in Zambia, and they were targeting Southwest Africa, Namibia, particularly the Caprivi Strip at that stage. Well-trained, well-armed, and with a lot of underage child soldiers as well, which is obviously against the UN Charter, but who needs consistency? 10,000 civilians in Southwest Africa were killed, mostly by landmines, terrorist attacks. These are just some actual pictures of what the landmines did to vehicles. I won't show you what it did to people, but if this is what it did to a Kombi and a Land Rover, a Bucky, and you can just begin to imagine what these car bombs did. All these came from Zambia, well, originally from Soviet Union or Red China, came through Zambia, and limpet mines in shops, a suitcase bomb in a butchery in Ondangwa, the post office in Ondangwa in Ovambaland. And so Kenneth Kaunda helped escalate conflicts all around. That's interesting. He's now called the Prince of Peace. Literally, that's one of the eulogies I've just seen. He's the Prince of Peace. And yet he caused conflicts in virtually every neighbor. What is the definition of a good neighbor? Do to others what you want them to do to you. Well, KK saw that vast quantities of Soviet weaponry poured into Zambia to equip these insurgents, and preemptive strikes brought suffering and disruption of roads and railways and bridges in Zambia. Weapons like these, the Makarov, the PSSH, the AK-47, this is the RPD, and this is the PKM, the RPG-7, rocket propelled gun, and the mortars, 82mm mortars and also the 60mm mortars. You can see the Russian Cyrillic script, the Chinese script, all came through Zambia. All kinds of Soviet-equipped mines, POMs, anti-tank mines, anti-personnel mines, jumping jacks, you name it. Vast quantities of Soviet weaponry that came through Zambia supplied terrorists who butchered people throughout Southern Africa, causing vast amounts of suffering. Just one example of how Kenneth Kaunda has the blood of innocence on his hand is when a Canadian tourist was murdered at Victoria Falls. 16th of May, 1973, after KK had particularly worked up anti-white, anti-Rhodesian hysteria on state radio and on state TV, Zambian security forces shot two Canadian women dead across Zambezi River at Victoria Falls. Now, Christine Sinclair, 20 years old, Marion Gerber, 19 years old, both from Ottawa, were tourists from Canada. They were wearing swimming suits. They could not have been mistaken for soldiers. At a tourist area, shot from across the Zambezi River, and they both had long hair, as you can see. No way could they be confused for Rhodesian soldiers or anything like this. And it's not known what was done to deal with those individuals responsible. This was the search and rescue team from Rhodesia who went down to try and find Marion, who fell into the gorge and was washed down river. They struggled to find her body because She was right by the edge. If you go back to this picture here, you can see this is Zambia on the right. This is Zimbabwe on the left. And so the Canadian tourists are on this side, and the Zambians must have shot from across there. So Marion would have fallen into the gorge here and been washed downstream. And so it was very hard to retrieve her body. But so this was the rescue team that had to go down to the gorge. Very dangerous operation. And there was an American badly wounded who recovered later, who was also shot the same day and same time. This is the family of these victims out to see the plaque that was put at the spot where they were shot. So Kenneth Kaunda pursued a very aggressive foreign policy. Here you can see Oliver Tambo of the ANC, Sam Nujoma of SWAPO, of course Julius Nyerere, KK in the middle. And here you can see again Sam Nujoma, Samora Machel, the mass murdering dictator of Mozambique, and Robert Mugabe. These people came to power to a large extent thanks to Kenneth Kaunda. And Kenneth Kaunda put his own country's interests really underneath the interests of the Marxist revolution. And Zambian people have complained to me how they often became victims. Said, our life was not safe. We couldn't go out at night because these terrorists could do what they wanted. They were the guests of the present. The police in Zambia were powerless against these brutal terrorists of ZANU, ZAPU, SWAPU, MPLA, FRELIMO. And so they could attack and abuse the local people of Zambia at will. And the local people lived not just in terror of Kaunda, but in terror of the very Marxist thugs he was hosting in his country. You can't hold a fire close to your chest without burning yourself. Kenneth Kaunda obtained 16 MiG-21 fighter bomber jets from the Soviet Union. Very advanced, more advanced than what Rhodesia had on their side. Kaunda pursued an aggressive foreign policy. He promoted sanctions on Rhodesia, even while receiving electricity from Rhodesia's hydroelectric plant at Kariba throughout the whole time of the war. So he's effectively at war with Rhodesia. And to Rhodesia's credit, they never turned off the electricity to Zambia, which they could have easily done. I mean, Kariba electric power plant was on the southern side of the Zambezi. Some of the specs on the MiG-21, very advanced for that time in the 1970s. Rhodesia's primary internal passenger carrying planes were the Viscounts. And I remember traveling by Viscount. You literally walked onto the runway. There was no security. And the air hostesses, you had air hostesses back then, not flight attendants, and said, please ensure that your firearms are safe, securely holstered, and that all rifles and machine guns are placed in overhead compartments. And there never was a hijacking of Rhodesian aircraft. However, there were two shooting down of Viscounts by the Zipra or ZAPU terrorists coming from Zambia. And these are details of two of the Viscounts shot down. And in one case, there were survivors, and those survivors were killed and eaten. These are the Soviet Strela radar missiles supplied through Kaunda to Zipra, to ZANU and ZAPU, who shot down these airliners, civilian airliners, on internal flights within the country. And here's Kenneth, this is Joshua Nkomo, who is a guest of Kenneth Kaunda the whole time of the war, dressed in a Soviet Union field marshal's uniform, holding his field marshal's baton, addressing Zipra terrorists in Zambia. And he came on BBC and laughed and said, yes, our boys did it. We did it. We shot down those planes. And he was proud of this. And the World Council of Churches gave him more money for doing so. This is just some of the civilian aircraft shot down. And I don't know if you've ever heard the sermon given, A Deafening Silence, by the Dean of St. Mary's Cathedral in Salisbury, but it's well worth listening to. You can listen to it on our Flame Lily Foundation Cape Peninsula Facebook page, and we've got links to the audio of this in the service where he spoke about the deafening silence in the world. Aircraft, civilian aircraft shot down, survivors of air crash brutalized, savagely murdered, and was there a word of condemnation from any of the Western leaders, from the Pope, Archbishop Canterbury? Not a word. Deafening silence. And these shooting downs of the Viscounts were just some of the fruit of Kenneth Kaunda's policies. He was very hypocritical and his economic policies were very counterproductive. KK campaigned for sanctions against South Africa, even while receiving vast benefits from South Africa, including maintenance of Zambian Airways. All the services of Zambian Airways was done by South African Airways. Zambian Railways, all the servicing of it was done by South African Railways. In fact, often it was South African Railways locomotives pulling their stock. The migrant laborers from Zambia to South Africa brought back hundreds of millions of dollars worth of income every year to help the failing economy of Zambia. Even when a Zambian needed a snakebite serum, it had to come from Pretoria in South Africa. While Zambians ate mealie-meal grown in Orange Free State, Kenneth Kaunda ranted against South Africa and against anyone who sought to trade with South Africa. And then the economic collapse was just catastrophic. The media and industry was nationalized under Kenneth Kaunda's leadership, and the economy collapsed. At independence, one kwacha equaled one British pound. In a museum in Lusaka, you can see the British pounds, or Northern Rhodesian pounds, transferring into Zambian kwacha. And the one grew to 50, grew to 100, grew to 10,000, and 10,000 kwacha couldn't buy what one kwacha had been able to buy at independence. And at the end, one pound equaled 8,000 kwacha. At independence in 1964, you could buy a car for about 140 kwacha. In fact, I've got a friend in Zambia who bought a car at independence at 140 kwacha. By the end of his reign, a bottle of Coca-Cola cost 1,000 kwacha. So that kind of gives you an idea of how things deteriorated. He also managed to bankrupt the richest state in Central Africa. The British left £2 billion sterling in the State Reserve Bank at independence in gold. I mean, honestly, how could you go wrong with that? But it wasn't long before Kenneth Kaunda's socialist policies had bankrupted the country. Zambia became dependent on foreign aid and the importation of food. It used to export food. Now it needs to import. Well, not anymore. In fact, things have changed so well in Zambia that they're now exporting food again, but that's, of course, after Kaunda's socialist policies have been abandoned. So just a few pictures I took of the nationalized industries in Zambia, giving you some of the sense of the great socialist utopia produced by nationalization and UNIP and the one state, one party principles of Kenneth Kaunda. Isn't it amazing how all these great factories just turn into so much scrap iron and rusting, molding wreckage within a very short while? And they have greed, they have covetousness, but they can't maintain it. So let me give a missionary perspective on Zambia under Kenneth Kaunda from prison. My first exposure to Zambia was on a mission in 1987. This is Cousin Gulu Ferry. This is the Botswanan side, that's the Zambian side. This is the Zambezi River, and that, by the way, is Southwest Africa. In 1987, that was Southwest Africa. And there was a South African observation post right there, camouflaged at that corner, that I could see as we went by ferry across from Botswana to Zambia. This is the one point in Africa where four countries meet. Zimbabwe, Zambia, Botswana, Southwest Africa, or now Namibia, all meet at that one spot there. Cousin Gulu Ferry. When I and three other frontline missionaries were arrested for refusing to pay a bribe at Cousin Gulu Ferry, we were arrested. We traveled over pothole-ridden roads which hadn't been maintained or repaired since independence 23 years before. We were imprisoned in filthy cells, crawling with hordes of insects, myriads of cockroaches, swarms of mosquitoes brought us down with malaria very quickly. It's interesting how those who profess belief in the goodness of man can be guilty of so much inhumanity. By the way, KK is famous for his white handkerchief. He's always waving his white handkerchief the whole time around, sort of mopping sweat from his brow and maybe waving away insects, but he'd be crying into his white handkerchief over the horrible Rhodesians attacking him every now and then. I mean, honestly, he could send terrorists across the border to murder farmers, missionaries, and bayonet babies, but at the moment he got one of his bridges blown up or something, he's weeping away. It's interesting that Kenneth Kaunda believed in the goodness of man because so much evil is done by people who believe in the goodness of man. This is a picture I remember seeing as a young boy in Rhodesia, 1976. This is Ian Sutherland, a Rhodesian who's captured by the Zambians, and you can see the chains around his ankles. And I saw this picture, and I remember thinking, How could he let himself be captured? I would never let myself be captured. The idea of being captured by communists who have no principles, no compassion, no restraint, to me was the worst thing. I didn't fear dying, but I had this real fear of being captured. And it was amazing how just 11 years later, I was in the same position being led through the streets of Lusaka, just like that, chained and shackled and hooded. After sleepless nights in filthy cells in Livingston, we were hooded, shackled, dragged at bayonet point, guided with rifle butts, 580 kilometers to Lusaka. And there we were paraded through the streets and thrown to Lusaka Central Prison. This is the Central Police Station downtown Lusaka, where they took our hoods off for the first time since we'd left Livingston. And that's the first thing I saw. And I looked at my handcuffs, and on it was written, "Made in Great Britain." And that was just so hilarious. I found it so funny. And while we hadn't drunk anything in the previous 24 hours, we were choking away laughing at this, you know, "Made in Great Britain." Thanks so much, Britain. We really appreciate you providing handcuffs here. Just to give a few contrasts with the colonial conditions. The British built Lusaka Central Prison for 80 people. There were 1,200 crammed into there by Kaunda's government in 1987 because he believed in the goodness of man. When the British imprisoned Kaunda for 9 months in Lusaka Central Prison in 1955, he had a cell of his own, room to himself, with a bed, with sheets, with desk, with chair and couch and gramophone and 3 cooked meals a day brought into him. He had access to a library, he had electricity, he had plumbing. However, and this is a picture taken by Rhodesian military intelligence, here's Lusaka Central Prison, main gates there, interrogation chambers here, administration block. This is the guard tower, the machine guns. The only door into the central prison was underneath here, a very small one you had to duck to go through. Here's the cooking shed, big cooking pots that could fit a whole missionary family in. And all that was in there was sadza and so on. And there's the death row. We were cell 11 right there. When we were incarcerated in Lusaka Central Prison 1987, there was no electricity, there was no plumbing, there was no sanitation. Each cell had 55 to 65 prisoners crammed into a room 25 feet by 15 feet. There's no airflow. The corrugated iron roof made the heat stifling. The only ventilation came from roughly a 1 foot square hole in the barred door. There's no beds, there's no furniture. Prisoners simply had to lie on our side, stacked in like sardines. Prisoners died in the cells and were dragged out the next day. The whole prison was a stinking disease factory. Disease and death was a constant reality in prison. We saw corpses being carried out of the cells. Now, obviously we didn't have cameras when we were prisoners, so this wasn't taken then, but I did go on a mission to Zambia in 1991 and managed to get the staged picture, illegally, of course, because Kaunda was still present. That's another story. We were locked in our cells from around sunset to sunrise, but we were allowed to walk around the dirty, overcrowded yard during the daylight hours. Most of the prisoners in there were remand prisoners. They weren't convicts. Now, you know, a remand is not meant to be in prison. He's meant to be in jail. But the jail's not big enough, so they just threw them in a prison. Prisons for convicts who've had their day in court and have been found guilty. Most of the people there were remand. Now, you could tell the difference because a convict wears a prison uniform. A remand prisoner is still wearing his civilian clothes, or should we say the tattered remains of what were his civilian clothes. And so most of the people there said they hadn't yet had their day in court. We were detained at the president's pleasure, quote unquote. We were placed in cell 11, a presidential detainee cell. So I was actually a guest of Kenneth Kaunda. Enjoyed his hospitality. In our cell were people literally from around the world. There was a tall Muslim businessman from Timbuktu, literally from Timbuktu in Mali. There's a man from Zaire. There's another man from Kenya, all spies for South Africa, apparently. Another man from Zimbabwe, also a spy for South Africa, they said. There's another young man from Malawi, also, of course, a spy for South Africa. There was a highly educated engineer who used to be a major in the Zambian army, locked up for saying, sanctions will hurt Zambia more than South Africa. There was a 62-year-old Indian citizen who was also in detention without trial. He's a father of 5, in jail in spite of being a millionaire, or maybe because of being a millionaire. Officials were greedy for his mining company, and so he sat in a presidential detainee cell without charge, without trial. Condemning the innocent or letting the guilty go free, both are hateful to the Lord. Detained without charge, detained without trial. A young black South African, Isaiah Moyo, who had been jailed for 18 months up to that point, was a truck driver with his wife and two children in Soweto. Isaiah had been framed by some ANC members, they called them exiles, who owed him some money, and what's easier than not paying him back but accusing him of being a spy? Because under a one-party dictatorship in Zambia, you didn't need evidence. You just needed a charge because, you know, you're guilty till proven innocent. There's no chance to prove yourself innocent. Isaiah had been severely tortured at Lilali Police Training Center. He'd been hung upside down with his head in buckets of water while being sadistically beaten. He'd been burned with red-hot pokers and his body was covered with sores that swelled up with pus and burst. He'd also been electrocuted. But we had singing in the cells. Now, we didn't have any Bibles, but we had Bible studies, from what we could remember. We didn't have hymn books, but we sang lots of hymns, again, from memory. Just shows how important it is to memorize the hymn books and the prayer books and the Bibles. We spent hours each day on our knees in prayer, especially with Isaiah, and Bible study, and we'd sing Christian hymns together. And when we sang Amazing Grace, you suddenly heard so many other cells joining in and singing that. The Lord knows when our spirits are crushed in prison. He knows when we are denied the rights he gave us. When justice is perverted in court, he knows. Well, as the leader of the team, I was dragged away for interrogation 6 times, literally dragged away, handcuffed and all that. And so over the next 2 weeks, incarcerated in this grossly overcrowded Lusaka Central Prison, I went through 6 intense interrogations with the Zambian Special Branch, military intelligence and the president's office. And I remember at one point, I could see that all of our materials on the table, including my Bible. And I said, you know, may I have my Bible? And this SB man, Special Branch, he pulled out a little red book and he said, no, but you can borrow my little red book from Mao. It's Mao's thoughts. So I looked at this, I flicked through it a bit. It wasn't English. And I handed it back to him and said, Mao Tse Tung couldn't walk on water. He couldn't multiply loaves and fishes. He didn't rise from the dead. He didn't heal anyone. He can't get you to heaven. And gave it back to him, and that did not get me any special treatment afterwards. But thankfully, prayer and pressure was being mobilized by a mission worldwide. Over 1,000 calls were made to the Zambian embassy in Washington, D.C., and concerned Christians, many of whom had been my guests out in South Africa before, were mobilizing. Representations made to the Zambian embassy personally by related missions protesting our detentions. The British Foreign Office reported getting 500 letters over complaining about our imprisonment. Now, all of us had British passports, although I'm a South African citizen. I'm South African born. My father fought all 6 years, Second World War, in the Royal Artillery and the Eighth Army. So by virtue of that, I've got a British passport, so I'm dual citizen. And it just so happened that all 4 of us happened to have British passports. One of us was an Australian, but he had fought in the British paratrooper, so he had a British passport too. And anyway, we were the British Foreign Office's problem. And the issue was taken personally by one of our good friends, Dennis Walker, who was once a cabinet minister in Ian Smith's government in Rhodesia. He is a personal friend, Rhodesia Christian Group. He went and he saw that the secretary of Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister of Great Britain at the time, received our details. And she was on her way to board a plane to go to the Commonwealth Conference, or we called it the Commonwealth back then. The Commonwealth was meeting in Vancouver in Canada, 13th to the 17th of October, 1987, providentially, while we were locked up there. And so, their Zambian dictator, whose president we were, who was chairman of the so-called frontline states, because in the frontline of the war against South Africa and all that, subjected Margaret Thatcher, Prime Minister of Great Britain, to haranguing over Britain refusing to place economic sanctions on South Africa. And there's Margaret Thatcher, the Queen, and there's KK smiling in the front row because he's one of the senior statesmen of Africa, so-called, or should we say dictators. Margaret Thatcher responded by asking, why does Zambia herself not place sanctions on South Africa? Well, Kenneth Kaunda responded that would place many Zambians out of work. Exactly, said Margaret Thatcher. And as South Africa is one of Great Britain's most important trading partners, placing sanctions on South Africa would place many British people out of work. Quite aside from many South Africans who'd be placed out of work as well. And then she exposed this double standards. She went on to relate how Zambians were dependent on maize grown in Orange Free State. Zambian Airways was maintained by South African Airways technicians. Zambian Railways was maintained by South African Railways technicians and locomotives. South African veterinarians cared for Zambia's cattle. Zambians were by the tens of thousands migrant workers in South Africa, working the mines, and a vital part of Zambia's ailing economy, bringing, in fact, most of what they earned went straight into the public treasury as tax. And then the Iron Lady silenced Kohinda and secured our release. KK declared that because of South Africa's human rights abuses, Britain should impose sanctions. It's at this point that Margaret Thatcher produced our information. Who are you to speak about human rights abuses? You are the unelected dictator of a one-party state. And then she challenged him. You have four British missionaries locked up without charge, without trial, in Lusaka Central Prison, being interrogated, tortured, and abused by your security forces right now. Well, Kenneth Kunda was dumbstruck. He was humiliated. I mean, this was KO, knockout. Margaret Thatcher, the Iron Lady, had won the day, won the debate. Kenneth Kunda had nothing to say. He could just sit there with his mouth open in shock. And apparently his first words when he came off the aircraft in Lusaka airport was, "Get those missionaries out of here." And a man from the president's office came and secured our release. And I didn't get this picture taken on that occasion. I didn't look that good at that stage. But this is on a later occasion coming back. He showed us the Freedom Monument as we went out. And he bought us some ice creams as we drove out of town to be reunited with our vehicle in Kazangulu Ferry and sent back across the border to Botswana. But I couldn't help but notice that the Zambian Freedom Monument is behind bars. You see, it's got a picture of a man breaking chains above, which the local people say he's trying to bring two magnets together. But you can see up there. Here you can get a better picture of it. The building behind was built by UNIP to be, built by the Chinese, I should say, for UNIP to be UNIP's headquarters. But before they could move into it, they got overthrown. Anyway, I just think it's so funny to have a freedom monument that's behind bars. Well, in 1991, opposition against KK was growing. And so I started to get contacted by his lawyer asking me to come back to Zambia because KK wanted to personally apologize for our abuse. Well, 3 years later, I thought, that's interesting. What's changed? Well, I quickly found out that Kenneth Kunda was facing such a lot of abuse over his resistance over his abuse of missionaries like us and so on. So he wants us to come back specifically to go on national television. Here we are. It's myself and Martha McComb, who we had, her first task was to set up Africa Christian Action. Remember, we had a message from her just recently by video. Well, this is on ZNBC, the only TV station in the country at that stage, prime time. And so this is the main thing. They wanted me to go on TV to show that, you know, hey, we're nice on missionaries, you know, give them freedom even to speak on TV. So I said to him, I know how this works. KK is in trouble, and he needs a public perception propaganda opportunity. Well, two can play at that game. If he wants me to come to Zambia to improve his popularity, that's fine. But I want access to Lusaka Central Prison, and I want the freedom to preach the gospel to the people. And I can't come empty-handed. I must be able to arrive with food and medicine and soap and salt and Vaseline and pens and paper and Bibles and all that sort of thing. So I had a whole list of things that I knew every prisoner wants. And it took a bit of negotiation, but finally, yes, that's not a problem. And to also, I was getting invitations to preach in different churches in Zambia who had been in contact with me since our imprisonment. And fair enough. So they allowed that, but I had to be on this TV program. Well, they made one serious error, and that is the TV program was live. And so this woman, this is the only picture of this thing, but this woman who asked the first question, you can see she's not looking too happy at this point. She said, "You must be so happy to come to Zambia in different circumstances from last time." So I took a deep breath and said, "Yes, Considering that last time, when we refused to pay bribes to your policemen at Kazangula Ferry, we were arrested, we were strip searched, we were thrown to filthy cells covered in human waste with thousands of insects and cockroaches and mosquitoes and came down with malaria, we're hooded and shackled, chained. You could just see her eyes widening, and the red light is still on me, the camera's focused on me, and there's nothing she could do about it. And I just carried on speaking about how we were transported by bayonet points into Lusaka Central Prison, which the British built for 80 prisoners, but there were 1,200 people, and most of whom were remanded, who hadn't even had the day in court, who hadn't even been charged yet and didn't have trial. In fact, we were thrown in the presidential detainee cell, and I went through the whole thing, no water, no electricity, and so on, you know, how the evil British colonials, they could provide three cooked meals a day to Kenneth Kaunda in his own room where he had, but he believes in the goodness of man. And here were 55 to 65 people in a single cell. That's 25 feet by 15 feet. I've just given this whole thing without taking a breath. Just, and I think that this propaganda broadcast was not what they had planned it to be. And this poor man was trying to get onto some other things. But I helped dig another dagger in for Kenneth Kaunda. Well, we had outreaches in the streets, and the man next to me there is Bishop Bonali Fili. Now, he is the man who blew the whistle on us being in prison. He came to the prison as a prison chaplain, and he saw us in those conditions, and he got it printed and made known outside that there were missionaries locked up in Lusaka Central Prison. So he is the first one to organize services and outreaches, and U-turn to God was the Crusades. And so this is all in 1991, still under Kenneth Kaunda. I'm in Lusaka having public meetings and ministering there, and Martha with her guitar in Kanyama Baptist Church. Night we shown Jesus' form against the wall with a 16mm projector. That's what we used to use before video projectors. And the opposition to Kaunda was growing. And they were under curfew and there were riots. And by 1987, Zambia had the second highest debt of any nation in the world relative to its gross domestic product. And so here, these are pictures I took in the museum since. No job, no money, no food for family. 27 years, UNIP and KK have failed us. UNIP must go. And rising opposition forced KK to allow the first multi-party elections in September 1991. And despite complete control of mass media and massive propaganda campaigns, I mean, he controlled ZNBC, ZNTV, he controlled the newspapers a whole lot. Well, Kenneth Kaunda's UNIP was delivered a crushing defeat. And Frederick Chiluba's multi-party democracy movement, MMD, won in a landslide with a 75% of the vote. And this nobody saw coming. Now, Kenneth Kaunda called his dictatorship one-party state the Second Republic. So Frederick Chiluba called his rule the Third Republic. And the movement for multi-party democracy was mobilized particularly to get rid of Kaunda. Frederick Chiluba had also been a prisoner in Lusaka Central Prison. I'm not aware of having met him there, but he was apparently in the prison same time that I was, but he wasn't in the detainee cell because he was a union leader and he was in the convict section. So while we might have been there at the same time, I did not personally know him at that time. But his vice president and his mentor, the spiritual father, General Godfrey Mianda, was a good friend of ours because of also being locked up in the presidential detainee cell, cell 11 in Lusaka Central Prison. And it's General Mianda who encouraged me to write the book, Biblical Principles for Africa. I came to Godfrey Mianda when he was vice president, and I gave him a whole pile of books, some of the books you see downstairs, you know, biblical economics and all sorts of things. And he groaned. He said, I love books. I love reading. But the demands of high office don't give me much time. Don't you have a small book? One that summarizes all of these. And so here I'm at Parliament delivering Biblical Principles for Africa, which have gone through multiple reprintings, over four editions in English, something in the region of 28,000 in English in circulation. They ordered hundreds to give to every member of Parliament there. We translated Afrikaans, we translated French, and another mission to Congo, where we had our largest biblical worldview seminar ever, with 3,000 people at a Biblical Worldview Seminar weekend. Well, our goal was Zambia for Christ. And Zambia moved literally from a communist leader to a Christian leader. And since 1991, I've frequently been invited to minister in churches and conferences on radio and TV throughout Zambia, running biblical worldview seminars and teacher training colleges. When General Meanda was Minister of Education, particularly organized that, we'd go to the teacher colleges, taking Understand Times with our good friend, Bishop Bonali Firi, the chaplain who first saw us in prison Lusaka Central and got word out about our conditions, Bible translation projects, the transformation from Kahunda's socialist dictatorship to the free market, multi-party democracy, the freedom of the press, freedom of religion of the MMD government was dramatic. President Chiluba committed Zambia to becoming a Christian country. He entered amendments into the constitution to that effect. Zambia is a Christian country. Abortion was banned. Pornography was prohibited. The Bible was returned to the classrooms. Commissars went out. Chaplains came in. Armed forces were opened to the gospel. National days of prayer, days of repentance, days of thanksgiving were observed. And this is one Zambia day of national prayer, fasting, repentance, and reconciliation. It was just one of many days called by the president. Political economic liberation Zambia 1991 to 2001. And it really was so. Before, under Kahunda, you could go out into the streets, Cairo Road, the main road in Lusaka, and try and find somewhere where you could buy something. You know, you'd want to buy some food. Or nothing open, nothing there. Gun shops, empty, empty. Well, since 1991, they've got every kind of choice. I mean, you know, Zambia's a different country today, completely different country. My father-in-law, Bill Bathman, went there, organized multiple ministry opportunities here in Zimbabwe National Radio. I took my son, Calvin, up, and we ministered in conferences and seminars and churches. And I found it important to take Calvin up there to show them that even youngsters can memorize the whole Bible, can memorize whole lots of the section of scripture. He was giving them E.E., Way of the Master, Ten Commandments, Apostles' Creed, Lord's Prayer. And that's where we used to swim across into Angola. Calvin here teaching us primary school, the E.E. Presentation, Pastors' Conference. And he even got onto national TV on that day. They brought the national TV to show this little boy who could recite so much of the gospel to them. So wonderful opportunities of ministering in Zambia. And this is one of the founding fathers of Zambia, who is a good friend of Kenneth Kahunda's. There's with the Biblical Principles of Africa. He, in fact, was Minister of Education. And he said, you know, under Kenneth Kahunda, things just got destroyed. I mean, nothing was repaired. Things just went to wreck and ruin. And to hear from him directly what happened and how they were afraid. They couldn't even a cabinet minister couldn't disagree with the president. This man's got his own testimony. General Ronnie Shikapasha, one time head of the Zambian Air Force, crippled in a car crash, told he'd never walk again. His wife got converted. He got converted. He got healed. He became Minister of Foreign Affairs, Minister of Home Affairs, Minister of Information at different times. He organized for us to meet with President Levi Mwanawasa, who came from a Jehovah's Witness background, was kicked out of his church for getting involved in politics because JWs don't allow their people to be involved in politics. I had a good hour discussing with the president, a whole lot of things, presented him with a Christian flag, prayed with him, and he joined the Zambian Baptist Church in Lusaka, was baptized shortly after that, and started to take a strong stand against Mugabe. Now, interestingly, when I met with Levi Mwanawasa, I congratulated him because at that moment, Zambia had just strengthened its currency against the pound for the first time ever. And he said, oh, don't thank me, thank Mugabe. I was a bit surprised. He says, all those white Zimbabwean farmers that he's kicked out, we've welcomed hundreds of them into Zambia, and they've managed to produce more food than we need. Now we're exporting food and we've been able to strengthen our currency and lower our debt rate. And so he said, so it's Mugabe who you can thank for improving the economy of Zambia. And, well, good sense of humor. But he went to the border, welcomed these farmers, said, Zambia's your home. We will give you land, loans, equipment, whatever you need. This is your home. And he welcomed there. And so Zambia was turned around by just that sort of insight. But Kenneth Kahunda needs to be put in the same rank as the Idi Amins and the Michelles and the Kwame Nkrumahs, who called himself the savior of the redeemer of Africa, he called himself, Jomo Kenyatta. These people were not really leaders or freedom fighters. They were oppressors and dictators. And the hero worship for Kenneth Kaunda is just sickening. And listen to this. This is one person's eulogy. The saint of peace you were. The commander of freedom fighters. I don't know why they call him freedom fighters when freedom doesn't ever come. Hater of tribalism. Well, that he was. Ambassador of HIV. Unifier of the country. Under one Zambia, one nation motto. We celebrate your life, Dr. Kenneth David Kaunda. We live to champion a legacy of peace and violent free country. I don't know how people can make these kind of eulogies, but this sort of thing, at this time while people are singing the praise of the previous dictator, Kenneth Kaunda, some thought needs to be given for the long-suffering people of Zambia who endured 26 years of Kaunda's misrule and oppression, along with many other victims of his autocratic rule. Now, just think of other eulogies for dictators. Remember when dictator Fidel Castro, the longest reigning dictator of the 20th century, when he died, president or dictator of communist China said, Comrade Castro will live forever. You wish. Castro is a great man of our time. History and people will remember him. French president Francois Hollande said, Castro represents for Cubans pride in rejecting external domination. Really? They let the Russians come in and oppress them. Venezuelan president called him, said, it's now up to us to continue his legacy. What legacy? Turning the paradise island of Cuba into a hellhole where people fled by the millions across shark-infested waters? And so there's all kinds of, you know, you just think, there's old Carter. We remember fondly our visits with him, with Castro in Cuba, and his love of his country. Love of his country? Obama nation. Recalling the countless ways in which Fidel Castro altered the course of individual lives, families, and of the Cuban nation. Oh, he altered the course of them for no doubt. Whereas Trump said, today the world makes the passing of a brutal dictator who oppressed his own people for nearly six decades. Now, which one do you think is more truthful? You can tell who the media hates the most. And that's the point. Castro's legacy is one of firing squad, theft, unimaginable suffering, poverty, and denial of fundamental human rights. No wonder the media hated Trump. He actually just said it the way it was instead of putting all kinds of sugar around it. Well, the classic has to be Justin Trudeau. We join the people of Cuba today in mourning the loss of this remarkable leader. So a whole lot of people... Sorry?
Trudeau's...
I know. So after this, a whole lot of Trudeau eulogies came out, like of Joseph Stalin, the greatest mass murderer of history. Mr. Stalin's greatest achievement was his eradication of obesity in Ukraine through innovative agricultural reforms. What about Sauron? Sauron is the ultimate bad guy in The Lord of the Rings. Let us remember Sauron, whose leadership united the disparate peoples across the lands of Middle-earth in a singular purpose. Or Darth Vader of Star Wars. While controversial, Darth Vader achieved great heights in space construction and played a formative role in his son's life. Or think of Tojo, dictator of Japan. While a controversial figure, General Tojo brought America to World War II and ultimately helped shorten the war. you remember who John Wilkes Booth is the one who shot Abraham Lincoln in the theater? John Wilkes Booth was a brilliant revolutionary and actor who leapt to fame after his one-shot performance. I mean, these are Trudeau eulogies, because after he could speak about Fidel Castro like this, just unbelievable. Jim Jones, you know who Jim Jones was? The cult leader who had hundreds of people drink poison and kill themselves? Jim Jones provided shelter and hydration to hundreds of Americans, and for that we will remember him fondly. You know who Hannibal Lecter is? Hannibal the Cannibal? Hannibal Lecter? If nothing else can be said for Hannibal Lecter, at least he had a great taste in people. You know who Genghis Khan was? Genghis Khan killed about 12% of the world's population with the Mongol invasions. I offer my condolences to the family of Genghis Khan, a controversial figure, but also created a bond between East and West. President Snow, Hunger Games? President Snow was a troubled leader, but one who knew the value of lasting entertainment for his districts. Now, I mean, really and truly, the amount of people who describe Fidel Castro as the longest-serving president. On now, just take these pictures. This is Justin Trudeau's parents. Justin Trudeau's mother, Margaret. That's Fidel, the guy with the cigar. You know, he's a dictator. This is Pierre Trudeau, who's he's known as a playboy. Who he married Margaret when he was double her age, and he was in his late 40s, and she is 18 when he met her. At any rate, older Pierre Trudeau was Prime Minister of Canada at the time. Okay, now you see that picture. This is little Justin Trudeau. Justin Trudeau, when he arrives in Havana, there's Margaret, and there's Fidel, and Fidel's happily picking up this baby. And just look at, this is what Fidel Castro looks like. That's what Justin Trudeau looks like. And yeah, there's Justin. Many people think Justin Trudeau was just eulogizing his own father, actually. Justin Trudeau's got to be the worst leader in the West. We should remember the many victims, the many civilians killed by Marxist revolutionary terrorists supported by Kenneth Kaunda's incursions into Angola, Mozambique, Rhodesia, Southwest Africa, and South Africa. Here is Joshua Nkomo, the one whose men shot down the Rhodesian Viscounts. There's KK. Natasha, 6 months old, bayoneted by terrorists who launched their attack from Zambia. Catholic missionaries murdered. Red Cross ambulance drivers. Father Arthur Lewis, the first board member of Frontline Fellowship, was a missionary for 48 years in Africa, including in Rhodesia. He wrote the book Christian Terror, which exposed the World Council Church's funding of the terrorists who murdered missionaries and Christians, such as the 13 missionaries at Elam. We just passed that anniversary on the 23rd. These are some of the victims of the terrorists. Just beyond comprehension. And here I took my children to the very field where the missionaries were killed in the Vumba, Rhodesia. On this field, they murdered 13 missionaries, including 4 of their children. Terrorists supported by the likes of Kenneth Kaunda. Not to mention those who were shot down by red-eye Strela missiles that came through Zambia. We all have an appointment. This death of Kenneth Kaunda should remind us that it's appointed unto man once to die and after to face judgment. Every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. When will you bow to Christ? The question is not whether you'll bow to Christ, but when. We will bow to Christ either today as Savior and Lord in the day of grace when the gates to heaven are wide open, or we can bow on the day of judgment, when the door to heaven will be firmly closed, when the day of grace is ended. But every knee will bow, either to him as Savior today or as Lord and judge then. Is Jesus Christ your Savior or your judge? When I went to Zambia after the overthrow of Kenneth Kaunda, I met with many members of the government who had been KK's cabinet ministers, who had worked with Kenneth Kaunda in UNIP, one-party state. They said to me, Kenneth Kaunda worshipped Satan by name. He wasn't just an animist, he wasn't just a Marxist, he wasn't just an atheist, he was a Satanist. He worshipped Satan. Satan would appear to him personally, bodily, in State House in Lusaka. I gave one of these, I can't believe your expressions. And he said, I know you whites don't believe us, but it happened. We saw it with our own eyes. And I really frowned and like, you've got to be kidding. And the whole of them, one was Zambia's ambassador to the United Nations. Another was a cabinet minister and so on. They're sitting around this room there and they're saying to me, we saw it. Satan appeared. It wasn't just Kenneth Kaunda. There would be Mobutu Sese Seko of the Congo, Mugabe, Samora Michelle, Agostino Neto. They all gathered here in State House for them and Satan would appear to them bodily. They worshiped Satan. And I was, no, come on, guys. And these men who I know to be Christians swore blind to me, Kenneth Kaunda really worshipped Satan. So I then quoted that, well, Michael Cassidy said in a passing summer that he was much impressed with Kenneth Gunda because he was a Christian gentleman. And they laughed and they slapped their knees and they said, you have a problem in South Africa when your Christians can't tell the difference between a Christian and a Satanist. And I don't know. I mean, I wasn't there. I don't have the evidence, but I can just say to you that this is what I was told. 1992, immediately after the overthrow of Gunda, by people who said that they knew him, who were in this, and these were high-level people in the government, cabinet ministers, ambassadors. And so I have no evidence that Kenneth Gunda repented. If he had, we would have heard some powerful testimony, a person who came from that kind of background. But the question for Kenneth Gunda is past now. It's too late for him now. He's in God's hands. But is Jesus Christ your Savior and Lord? Because, you know, you might delay judgment a long time. Kenneth Gunda was given 97 years, for goodness sakes. Wow. But none of us will be able to avoid ultimately standing before God. Is he your Savior or is he your eternal judge? So, any questions, any comments? It's good to look at Zambia at this time to remember to pray for the people of Zambia. I just find it nauseating that a man who made the Zambians suffer so much and stole so much of their future from so many people, snuffed out people's lives, that he gets praised. And then you think, but what about the people who are his victims? So this is a good time to remind people of what really matters. Questions, comments?
Did you get Daniel? Very much of the life of the church under his rule, as far as, you know, sometimes during persecution, it can seem in churches less, but there's a thriving church. Did you get a sense during some of the time there what
yes.
the church looked like in that period?
I did. In fact, my first contact was with, well, of course, the prisoners, and it was a lively Christian fellowship in the prison who welcomed me in and invited me to preach, and it was wonderful times of worship in the prison. But then through Bishop Bonali Firi, even when I went in 1991, while Gunda was still present early in 1991, and the churches were vibrant, the enthusiasm for the gospel was great. And while they plainly knew they couldn't talk in politics, but by 1991, the churches start to move to pray for the removal of UNIP and for the downfall of Gunda. And although these churches did not have a political agenda, they were brave and courageous. And this Bonali Firi was willing to stand up with me, not only on TV, but in the public square, preaching gospel. And I was straightforward against communism, against atheism, against secular humanism. I really took down humanism and exposed what's wrong about humanism. And that was the prevailing ideology. And Zambian church people were standing with me, enthusiastic. I got the impression that churches were strong. And I was told that it was the church's opposition to one-party state that brought about the first multi-party elections. So I think, yes, the church in Zambia did seem to have been very, very strong. And I got the impression that the church back in the 90s, 90, 91, throughout the 90s, was much stronger than it is right now. I think the freedom and the peace they've had and the prosperity they've enjoyed, the material abundance in the last 23 years, has perhaps made the next generation weaker. So right now, I think Zambia needs to be reminded of where they came from, and their churches used to be a lot stronger than are now.
Which sorts of denominations were you working with primarily during that time in Zambia initially?
Initially it was the Baptists, because Bonali Firi is Baptist, he is my first contact. But since then we got involved in a lot of the independent churches, many of the charismatic churches. But I would say first it was the Baptist. The Reformed Baptists are particularly strong at the moment, but there's a lot of independent churches in Zambia. But yes, they were. There's been a plethora of more denominations that have grown since 91 because of the religious freedom. Before that, it was more stifling, you know, more denominations. And so the many denominations you now see in Zambia is a sign of the extra freedom they've now been enjoying.
How long were you in jail?
16 days. A day's a long time when you're in that kind of condition. Of course, we didn't know how long we'd be there. I thought I'd be there for a few years. And at that stage, it's the height of the AIDS scare. We're walking barefoot on filthy ground with broken glass and things like this. And I must say, I thought I'm going to die of AIDS. You know, that's just the way we were thinking at that stage. Didn't think I'd ever get out of the prison. But there's not a day that goes by that I'm not grateful for running water, hot water, clean sheets, clean pillowcases, things like that. It's just, we should all actually have an occasion when we're deprived of these things to make us appreciate things like soap and clean water and good food. And, you know, most people don't appreciate the blessings of God on a daily basis because they've never been deprived of them.
Do you know if they
There are stories, yes. So one of the nicest ones is that on my first... Now, because of this experience, I came out of Zambia, and I must say, first thing I did was wash in the Zambezi River, and then the first place we came to in Botswana, I got a bath, and I put Dettol in, and I had double bath. I don't want to tell you how filthy we were, and I just didn't feel like I was... It took quite a lot to get me to feel clean. But... as I came back, I met with people like Don McIlvaney. Some of you have met him or his grandchildren. And he encouraged me, you must come to America. And I said, why? He said, you must tell about this. I said, what can I tell Americans that they don't know? You've got the most advanced telecommunications system in the world. He said, I tell you, our people don't know this. You need to come tell them. It sounded a bit bizarre. I had never thought of going to America any more than I'd think of going to Mars. You know, why would I go to America? And I mean, it's other side of the world. And it seemed bizarre to me, but I was talking to going there, and then I got an invitation to speak at the Frankfurt International Society for Human Rights, ICHR, in Frankfurt, International Conference. And I got invitations to go to London, and I got opportunities to even speak on the BBC World Service and all that. Well, on the BBC World Service, I went on this 11-week, three-continent, five-country mission, and it cost me R1,000, 1988 money. But anyway, that's the airfares and everything. Just to show you how money has been debased, but on the BBC World Service, I particularly brought forward Isaiah Moore's case, as I did in Frankfurt. And I was told later by Isaiah, he said, the prison wardens came running towards him with a shortwave radio, Isaiah, that's South African missionary. He's on the radio. He's talking about you. And they opened the prison doors, and he got to hear the end of the radio program when I even gave Isaiah's address. And he said they drove mail sacks of letters and parcels into him. Soap and food and chocolates and all sorts of things and pens. And he said he is the most popular person in prison. He became a celebrity. The wardens couldn't do enough for him. Nobody mistreated him anymore. And very shortly afterwards, he went free. Because publicity and prayer provides protection for the persecuted. And I also campaigned for several other people who came free. But Isaiah actually saw him reunited with his wife and children in Soweto and all that. And so a lot of good things happened out of it. And many people became friends. But this opened up my eyes to prison ministry, literally. And that... the Lord has said that what we loose will be loosed, what we bind will be bound. And you know, we have power through correspondence, through prayer, through persuasion to help people come free. And that's how people like Richard Vonbrand got free from 14 years imprisonment in Romania. People outside campaigned for him. In fact, Norwegians paid, I don't know if bribe's the right word, or ransom to let him out so that he could go into exile. So Richard Vonbrand could write Tortured for Christ and start Voice of the Martyrs and so on. And I can say I'm out of prison specifically while I'm still alive because there are people who prayed and there are people who pressured and there are people who protested. And that does make a difference. So, yes, there's some very good stories that came out of it. And it's fun times. I'd go to Lusaka and we'd be having a meal and everybody around the table would be people who had been in Lusaka Central Prison. And, you know, people like Godfrey Meander and so on. And it's just... amazing, because you know, you'd think that that's the worst thing that could happen. And in my mind, as a youngster, that was the worst thing that could happen. And yet I must say, looking back, it's one of the best things that could happen. We did more ministry in that prison, and because of that prison experience, than we would have done if we'd done our originally planned mission of going up to Malawi and working for Malawi into Mozambique. So it wasn't our plan. But God had a better plan. Not that I would have thought so at that time. I mean, at the time I thought, God, why have you done this? Why have you dropped us? Why have you abandoned us? It looked like a catastrophe from our perspective. And yet it wasn't at all. But I mean, when you know the end, it's a whole lot easier, but at the time you don't know, so a lot of it is the fact of the fear of the unknown, which is why we should not fear. We should, you know, I don't know what the future holds, but I know who holds the future. Yes?
You said when Kenneth Kaunda was president of Zambia, it negatively impacted the countries around it. But when he became Christian in the 1990s, did that also positively affect the surrounding countries, or was it largely contained?
No, excellent, excellent question, observation. Zambia, as before, it had been a staging post for revolutionary insurgency operations into the neighboring countries, which resulted in death. After 91, it became a missionary sending center, not only radio as well. They were broadcasting like Christian Voice all throughout Africa, shortwave radio all over Africa. But missionaries were going out, including Bonali Firi, had 70 evangelists going mostly into Mozambique and into Zimbabwe. And Zambia became a great missionary sending country, and it is still to this day. It's doing a lot of good in all the neighboring countries around it. Even the Copper Belt, they're going across into Lubumbashi, Katanga province of Congo, and it's phenomenal. So just as Zambia was, I think, a great curse for its neighbors back in the 70s, it's become a great blessing for its neighbors since the 90s. And it's an island of stability in a bit of an ocean of chaos. And since then, you've seen a lot more stability actually come to the neighboring countries. There's been a lot of changes since 91. And again, you've got to remember the sequence of events. The Soviets were defeated, and the Cubans in Angola in 1988. They left in 89. The Berlin Wall came down in 89. The Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. Zambia had its first free elections end of 1991. Angola started free elections, Mozambique, 1994. And you started, South Africa had its first multi-party elections with all on the same voters roll back in 1994. So a lot of things happened when the Berlin Wall came down, the Iron Curtain collapsed, and the Soviet Union collapsed. All these dictators lost their support. And with the Soviets out of the picture, a lot of these countries could sort out their problems easier. So many people missed the key thing of the Cold War and what a massive impact it made with the Soviets losing the Cold War and the cause of freedom being able to advance as a result. The end results were good. So yes, that's why we went to starting to do a lot more work in Zambia and planted at Bible College, Petioka, Covenant College in Petioka, which started to send graduates across the border. So yeah, all very strategic. Any other observations, comments?
And that specific part would be kicked out. Can happen yet too?
It can, yeah. And in fact, we're approaching that time. They've been in for 26 years. KK was in for 27. So I think we're coming up to a good time where, and I'll say, you've passed your sell-by date. It's time to move. Yes?
Just a brief observation. Perhaps the phrase freedom fighter was intended that he fought freedom.
Yes. This is the thing. A lot of people call themselves freedom fighters. You can say, okay, where's the freedom? Because, you know, I'm a freedom fighter, and you're not allowed to have a different opinion, and no other party is allowed to exist. And, you know, what freedom? Yeah, quite right. Anyway, we just must have a bit of a sense of humor when they start praising people like they praised Fidel Castro just a few years ago. It's the same sort of thing. It's a bit nauseating, but think of Justin Trudeau eulogies, and you know, make a joke out of it, because it's the most effective way of being able to ridicule these people. It's biblical. Elijah, Jeremiah, they ridiculed the idol worshippers and so on. You chop down a tree and part of the wood you make a fire and cook some food, and another part you make a god and you bow down and worship it. You know, and in fact, when what they're doing is ridiculous. That's the way you can get through to some people. No, I don't. But his parents were grieved as to how he left the faith. And I believe that his parents and most of his other siblings stayed true to the faith. Kenneth Kaunda was he's the youngest, and he just went off the tracks. It's sad because he had a very fine family. You go to Malawi today, and the people speak very well of David Kunder. David Kunder was a great evangelist. And that's another thing, if you go to Jonas Savimbi's past, Jonas Savimbi, the head of UNITA in Angola, his father's a fine evangelist. And now also think where most of the communist leaders got their training, Fort Hare University. Fort Hare University started as a Presbyterian mission college. And somewhere along the line, the state took it over, and now Fort Hare produces Marxist, atheist, revolutionary, secular, humanist. So we've got to be so careful that we don't lose. It might start Christian, but it's going to continue Christian. And every single generation needs to experience revival, because in a sense, every movement is one generation away from extinction. If the next generation doesn't get the vision, I mean, this is a marathon race, and you've got to pass the torch. And so we've got to think of God as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God does not have grandchildren. You must be having a personal faith. You can't just have your parents' faith. And that's why it's so important that each person grapples for themselves. And in the case of Kenneth Kunda, he had excellent parents, excellent upbringing. He had privileged childhood. He had excellent education. But he chose humanism. Tragic. Yes, his father converted to Christianity from Judaism, and he wrote these articles written by Karl Marx when he was young on the power of the Holy Spirit and the importance of key Christian doctrines, and then later on he started to become a Satanist. So, but there's a choice. Life is 10% what happens to you, 90% how you react to it.